right, man. Welcome to Crow 777 Radio. This is hour one of episode 695. It's me and Jason Lindgren to open. In hour two, we are honored to have Michael Hoffman, the co-author of King Kill 33, with James Shelby Downard. The information that Michael Hoffman brings is one of a kind. You're not going to find it anywhere else. I mean, you think that's a fair statement, Jason? I think you're literally going to find it nowhere else.
I would say he is a one of a kind in this world today.
And I think he would say that he owes at least the avenue he's traveled, the beginning of it, to Shelby Downard. And if you have not read King Kill and you want to support Michael Hoffman, go to his website. We'll make the links available under the episode here. Even though you can find King Kill for free, it's not that much money if you want to support him. Also, he puts out a weekly article that you should absolutely subscribe to. Writing at this level and knowledge at this level is going to leave our world when his generation, and particularly him, is no longer with us. Would you add anything there, Jason?
Well, his first big book that he put out, too, is absolutely magnanimous.
Yeah, the earliest three books he put out, and then, I'm just going to put links to all of them. There's just too much to cover. But if you have not read King Kill 33, you have not been shown the way things are done at the occult level. Basically, the reason Jason and I are tacking on this hour one is to maybe demonstrate why I say belief is the enemy of knowing, and why that tagline at the top of every episode images. Basically, what Shelby and Michael Hoffman are showing is that the powers that be use occult means to transmute the human mind, to de-evolve it, to make it less than it was. The reason this works is because alchemy works. You can take it into a laboratory and you can apply it, and it works, but it also has the philosophical principle. People have heard the old fairy tale idea that, oh, they're going to turn lead into gold. Well, wow, that's actually possible. It's an encoding for the idea that the human mind starts as lead and can be spiritually transmuted into gold. What's going on in our world is kind of like the opposite of that, taking the potential for gold in the human mind and transmuting it into lead. And along the way, in the second hour, Michael Hoffman points out, can you actually refute the idea that we've devolved over the past few decades? I mean, do you want to add anything before I jump into these points, Jason?
Well, the book I was referring to, first of all, was Secret Societies and Psychological Warfare. Michael Hoffman is what I consider an old school, some of the first guard of conspiracy and truth and all of that, much like Bill Cooper was, except that he's still around with us. And I think that we need to appreciate him while he's still here. The writing he does is at a level that a lot of people just don't seem capable of doing anymore.
I can't write at the level Michael Hoffman writes. As a matter of fact, I have to look up words. And I've got a pretty good vocabulary. I grew up with a PhD for a father, so I've got a very good vocabulary, and I have to look up many of the things he says. I'm always learning. But in the book Jason just mentioned, if I'm not mistaken, he covers the monolith from the movies and from Ground Zero magically showing up in a city. And I think that's the only other place that covered it. I mean, I think it was briefly in the news or something, but don't you think, Jason, that book's really the only place that covers what happened?
Well, again, he's part of the old guard, so people picked up on it later, but as far as really getting it out there before anyone else, absolutely.
So what Jason and I are going to attempt to do here is try to translate in basic terms why what Michael Hoffman is laying down is important, because many people are not familiar with alchemical ideas, much less the idea of occult operations. And again, read King Kill. If you read King Kill, you will have been shown something that is not available anywhere else, as far as I know. If it had not been for James Shelby Downard and the sacrifices he made in his lifetime, and he did make sacrifices, they were on him like white on rice. It's astonishing when you read his lifetime. But we're going to jump in with the idea of belief. I say it all the time, belief is the enemy of knowing. If we look at something like Christianity in the West, the way I was brought up, I was in Sunday school every week till I was about 14, being raised Christian. The most important thing that they were trying to instill in me is that I have to believe this certain thing. That was it. That was the whole thing. What I believed was the main goal of all of it. Now, don't let that idea leave your mind. because all these occult things that are going on, many of them, from my point of view, and Jason will give you his if he wants to, it's based on belief. During the course of the hour with Michael Hoffman, he brings up the Trinity site. I ask him, well, what's that about? What he basically says is it was an occult operation using alchemical means and occult spellcraft, for lack of better terms, to take the Holy Trinity and replace it with the atomic Trinity. So now what we're doing here is we're setting a literal ground zero. And by the way, that's probably the first time the term is used, is during the supposed nuclear blast. Michael Hoffman, knowing from where I'm coming from, said some people don't believe in it, and I don't. Jason, do you accept that the nuclear weapons exist as described?
My jury is out because I see things from both sides.
Okay, so Jason's still examining. From my point of view, I don't accept that they exist as described. What's more is at the supposed Trinity site, what I accept happened was they got everybody to believe what they needed to be believed, depending on the first law, Hermetic law, mind precedes all. In other words, whatever your mind believes in, it doesn't matter if it happened or not, because the whole world believes it happened. In the same way, when I went to Sunday school, I was not being told to go into a room to further my mental spiritual abilities. I was simply being trained to believe in certain things. The idea here is that the atomic Trinity was going to replace the kind of Christian-based society that had been built up in America. There's a lot of parts that veer off to what Jason and I have covered from JPL and Parsons. Doesn't Michael say at one point that Parsons is a known Satanist? I think he says that in hour two, Jason.
Yeah, I think he did.
So having said that, that should tell you something critically important, because this is a man that JPL and NASA turned into a hero. Michael Hoffman points out that he's basically a psychopath and maybe mentally unsound, even having carnal knowledge of his mother, which was demonstrated. And yet they hold him up as this great person, even knowing that he's a Satanist. Here's the rub. Apparently, he was the best rocket engineer that had ever come along, or something like that. How would you describe it from the NASA point of view, Jason, for Parsons?
Well, I don't know if it's necessarily that he was the greatest, but in the time period we're talking about, which is the 1930s, there really were hardly any people at all doing any sort of rocket study, because a lot of people didn't think that rockets could work the way they found out that, of course, they do work. So Jack Parsons had a huge interest in that. Calling him a Satanist, I don't know if that's 100% accurate, although dark stuff is definitely what he was into. He was into the whole Crowley thing, the Thelema and all of that. And yeah, that's dark stuff. I wouldn't necessarily call it Satanism, because that implies that you're getting involved with Christianity, and I don't think that really interested him very much, anything from a Christian point of view. He was into a lot of the older styles of magic that Crowley kind of collected and put together and then put out in his own way. Parsons was very, very dedicated to it. And then, of course, once the King Shyster himself, L. Ron Hubbard, came around, he contributed to that for about 2 years until Hubbard stabbed Parsons in the back. And that was kind of the beginning of Parsons going down. That seems to have really done a number on him, because he started making mistakes after that. And the government didn't seem to like very much that they were doing crazy goat dances and things like that before launches, which really didn't help his reputation at all. But because he was doing things that no one else really was at the time, he got away with it for a while until he no longer could. Because once it was proven that rocket science was a viable thing, other people started getting into it.
I mean, didn't he create like the JATO rocket and the other things that were like really important tech early on? I think I remember that. I don't know if that's right.
Fuel sources was one of the big things. And one of the earliest things he did that really helped big time was a jet assist lift during World War II for aircraft. The government bought a ton of those off of him because it helped save fuel and get craft up in a much more quick manner, which was needed during the war.
That's what I was calling the JATO. So maybe I got you tend to remember things better than I do. So maybe I got the name wrong, but I thought it was the JATO. But
no, I think you got the name right.
Just for the sense of people listening, I accept that defining him as a Satanist is okay, but I understand exactly why you're laying it down the way you did. Do you agree that we can at least call it evil?
Oh, very dark, for sure. Crowley wasn't exactly a Little Mary Sunshine.
Right. Evilest Man Alive, I think, was his moniker at one point.
Yeah, but he was his own best PR agent, too.
Now, that's true, too. But let's face it. I mean, he made it. For some reason, he shows up on the album covers and the music of our era. For some reason, he was appreciated, to say the very least, by some very mainstream things. But to get back around to the point, there are some things that are attributed to Parsons, like the homunculus, which is also referred to as the moon child. Do you remember much about that outside of what Michael Hoffman brought?
A little bit. Depends upon what you're asking.
So there's what he did is he ties it to the supposed Trinity blast, that the idea they were going to make this new being, a moon child, a homunculus, to usher in a new age was somehow tied to the physical explosion. And by the way, at one point, he tells you that on the day they did the explosion, which I accept was conventional explosives, the mushroom cloud is not distinct to supposed nuclear weapons. A big enough blast from nearly any source, maybe that's not a good way to say it, a big enough blast from the sources like TNT that we're used to will create a mushroom cloud, and yet it was branded as this is a nuclear happenstance. The idea was they were going to do this big explosion, they had this device, which Michael Hoffman describes, and they were going to birth, supposedly, a homunculus or moonchild. That idea, Jason.
Yeah, well, they had a lot of crazy ideas, the Scarlet Woman being another one.
Right, right, exactly. So the problem is there's this other legend, which I had thought was more viable, that what Parsons actually did was opened up some kind of a portal and let bad things in. And because of the magical operation, this is how the legend lays it down, he was the only one. Since he opened it, he had to be the guy to shut it, but he went and got himself blowed up. So he died, supposedly having opened up this portal or something, letting evil into our world. And I think you did touch on that, Jason, when you did the breakdown.
Oh, yeah. No, that seems to be something that they did a ceremony that hypothetically opened a gateway to somewhere else, and they never closed it. And that's kind of something that other people have looked into, that, hey, maybe he really did open a doorway to somewhere, and not so nice things have been using it since.
I mean, it's not hard to imagine with what we've seen in the world recently that most of us probably didn't even think was possible. To take it back to what Hoffman's about to lay down in hour two, there are two major events that kick off the kind of de-evolution, the active alchemical operation that's already been going on to hold human consciousness down to the point of idiocracy or something like that. That's killing the king, which was the supposed assassination of JFK, and the nuclear blast at the Trinity site. Now, in King Kill, they go to great lengths to show the Trinity encoding into the JFK assassination. Now, I think Jason accepts that JFK was assassinated. Is that true, Jason?
For the most part, but as with all these things, I'm always open-minded to alternative ideas because there's just so much crazy stuff around them.
Right. So if he heard something new tomorrow, maybe he would shift what he's thinking. What I have come to accept is true, and I put a lot of time into this, but this is just my point of view, is that he was a character on the stage and the same thing was going on. It was belief that they needed across the world to do this. Early on, when before YouTube was completely controlled, they had some of the best clips that went at things like the Zapruder film. They showed how it was put together and released 10 years after the fact. They had a survey team go to Dealey Plaza and they compared it forensically to the footage showing that the whole thing was a manipulation. There was so much good work done that just isn't available anymore. But to get past that, all the encoding of the Trinity again, like the triple overpass, the 33rd parallel, and all the things that went into the blast, there's a version of that around JFK. And I think it's important to point out, because it's not obvious, that basically Michael Hoffman's saying we had a morality, which Jason and I have covered in the 50s. I mean, explain it, Jason, what we've said so many times about the morality we lost after the 50s.
Yeah, the 50s and then the first couple of years of the 1960s were the end of classic Americana, that people hopefully know what I'm talking about. Just the way things used to be, very family oriented, that sort of thing. Once the counterculture revolution kicks in, which is around 65-ish is when it really kicks off, especially with the music scene and the drugs, everything changes and it's never, ever gone back.
Right. And particularly from people of Michael Hoffman's generation, the main thing that had come under attack was the Christian values that had built the society of the West. And I'm not going to take issue with that one bit, because that was a lot of it, that kind of leave it to Beaver mindset. Jason and I have covered how in a single decade, the 1960s, the foundational precepts of what it meant to be an American had been decimated. The family unit was destroyed. The normalization of drugs was put in place. Everything else that we've covered. This is all part and parcel of what Hoffman and Shelby are showing was intentionally done to de-evolutionize the human consciousness. And let's not forget bands like Devo. What do you think the name Devo means? It means de-evolution. Listen to some of the lyrics of the Devo music. But this is the main supposition of what's being offered. So Hoffman covers that on July 16, 1945, it was announced in the news that the sun rose twice. Jason, how many times have we shown how the sun is encoded for the person of Jesus or the idea of Christianity in general? I mean, what would you say about that?
The sun is everything. It is the main symbol encoded for not just Jesus, but so many things. And it is used in so many government things, just everything. The sun symbolism is supreme.
Next time you're watching any movie on Jesus, watch for the shot of the sunset or the sunrise. I guarantee you're going to see it, because it is so tightly encoded. And as Jason points out, it's not just Christianity alone, but in our time, it is unmistakable, the encoding of the light of the sunrise in the east, all these ideas. Well, on June 16, 1945, there is the explosion that they made that they claim is nuclear, and then the sun rose. And this is part of the alchemy, that basically the real sun was preempted by their pseudo sun. And this is part of the alchemical operation. Do you want to mention anything about that? I mean, it's kind of self-evident.
Yeah, I'm not really sure what to add to that, but I certainly agree with it.
It really is self-evident. So there's a few things, like, let me grab one at random. How about daylight savings time? We've covered a lot that daylight saving time was intentionally implemented to destabilize us, to detach us from nature and the cycles of nature where all truth is found. And to detach people from truth is to make them more liable to believe in false things. It's just, it's a truth for whatever reason. And it can be demonstrated over and over again. Did you know that the initial name for daylight savings time, at least by the time it was implemented for the second or third time in World War II, was war time zone? You can actually look it up. Go ahead. The war time zone. And so this kind of begins to demonstrate how wide this alchemical operation is. We have pointed out many times that it's not just that they're breaking the circadian rhythm or whatever you want to call it to be in tune with the cycles of the sun and the cycles of nature, which are so carefully encoded to Christianity. They change the clock by an hour to further throw us off. It was literally called war time zone, and the offset was no different than central, by the way, because I looked it up today. So it was another aspect of these universal things that are implemented. But what do we know about that now? Recently, and you probably know better than I do, it's coming up for debate again, isn't it, Jason, of whether or not they're going to allow daylight savings time to go on?
Well, actually, what they're proposing is just to leave it on. So we're not going to go back to standard time. They're just going to keep that 1 hour difference instead of falling back.
So do you know if that makes sunrise at around 6 o'clock at some time? Are you even, I mean, I know that's a big ask, but.
Well, I can look it up real quick.
It would be handy, because there was an idea in certain things that I've read that the sunrise at 6 a.m. was a standard for a certain period of time. And I'm wondering if leaving it the way it is just one last shot in the testicles on their way out the door, or whether it's not. So I'll give Jason a chance to look that up.
Well, a lot of people have a problem with the jacking back and forth and back and forth and back and forth. So
That is the main problem. Absolutely. And by the way, just to be clear, it's done at the equinoxes. So in this hypermaterial 3D world, there are 2 days where the physical world, the natural world of truth, provides equality. And how does it provide equality? Well, at the very foundations of what it means to be here. The dark time of night and the light time of day are balanced to the second. 2 days a year. So we get the idea in a truth system like nature of balance only twice a year in this place. Did you find anything worth mentioning?
Yeah, so right now, according to my weather app, sunrise for my area is 6:34 a.m.
So it's close. So I'm not sure that it means anything that they're leaving it the same instead of adjusting to move forward. But my main point in bringing this up is if we do shortly come to a point where that ends, that is a big demonstration that the eras of deception that we've been living through are coming to an end. Why are they ending now? In my view, it's because they have to, because the energies of the coming era are something different than the energies that allowed them to function in that way. And this is part and parcel of what Michael Hoffman is laying down. The energies and the world condition that allowed these alchemical, occult, spellcrafting things to go on that has literally pushed us towards the edge of the idiocracy. I mean, how often, Jason, do you hear someone say, do you think we're going to be at the idiocracy? What I'm asking now is, are we already kind of there at the idiocracy?
Oh, there are certain aspects that I don't think it's as bad as that movie portrays, of course. People aren't naming themselves after fast food snacks and things like that. But yeah, there are certain aspects that unfortunately are definitely creeping into society, Western society especially, more and more.
And there are other tells, like the idea that we now have a generation that can't read a wall clock, an analog wall clock, nor, this is a bigger one, nor can they read cursive writing because nobody taught them.
Which is huge. I cannot massive. Stress that enough. That is huge. If they take that away from future generations, you know how people are. They get lazy. It's like, I can't read that. I'm just not going to bother. Okay, well, now what massively important historical documents are you just glossing over like it's nothing?
Right. Are we going to have a generation that's in charge that can't read the Constitution? I mean, is that a thing that could even happen? And what's more, I uncovered in making episode images that apparently one of the reasons they didn't want cursive around is because AI couldn't deal with it. And all the people that are old like me, or even Jason for that matter, because he lived most of his life having to read cursive. Everybody knows when you get that letter, you can't read everyone's handwriting. You kind of put it together by length and shape and number of letters. Reading cursive is an art form on its own. Apparently AI had real difficulty. But I mean, come on, a generation that can't read the Bill of Rights, the Declaration of Independence, or the Constitution, regardless of how true you feel any of them are, the inability to read those, I mean, is there a bigger idea, Jason, I would ask?
Well, I don't know about how things are now, but right after we learned just regular standard letters, it was grade school that we were being taught cursive. By the time I was in junior high, which is for us, it was 6th, 7th, and 8th grade, that's all we used. That is what we used was cursive.
That's a fact. If you go a little further back and within my lifetime, every letter and correspondence that was made by hand and handed around, almost, I would estimate 90% of it was written in cursive. And if you go back to just before me, because I can remember when I came through my earliest grade school, when I was learning how to write cursive on those specially printed paper they printed for us to teach us how to shape the letters, penmanship was no longer being taught. It ended right about as I was going through school. But just prior to me, penmanship was part of it. So not only did you have to write cursive, if you wrote sloppily and you took a test, even if you got everything right on the test, if it was sloppy, you got dinged. You were not going to get an A because the penmanship mattered. And the reason I'm pointing, this is a whole different mindset than we currently have with regard to school.
Now, what you're saying is discipline. You had to have discipline. And a lot of that has been thrown to the wayside. And you can see it with the way a lot of people act these days.
And I heard rumors recently from somewhere that now they're starting to question whether cursive should be put back on the docket. And these are big tells. They don't seem like much, but these are big tells. If they do put it back on the docket, again, I would cite that this is evidence that we're moving further away from the age of deception. My whole idea here is that what Hoffman and Downard showed us was the open decode of how they were trying to take iron-fisted control for the age of technology when they could control every human being in real time to the point where they didn't have to care where the energies of the age were. At least that's what I suspect is true. What I suspect is actually going to happen is you can't stop the tide from coming in. Nature is going to have its way. The, for lack of better terms, vibration will go up, as will consciousness and spirituality of human beings. But what do we have to go through before we can get there? Will it happen in a year, or will it happen in a decade, or something worse? And to me, Jason, this is the whole reason what James Shelby Downard and Michael Hoffman provided for us is a big, big deal.
Well, you got to think about when they were initially doing their work, which was the 1970s. Michael Hoffman was a young man, and Downard had lived through many of the big, big events of the 20th century. And that's what he passed on to Michael Hoffman. Michael Hoffman says that he was his mentor. So these are people who are fading from our history now. Once they're gone, they're gone. He's of a vintage that they know how things used to be and how they aren't now. So of all these things we're talking about, what they're taking away from young people, discipline, history, all of that, what are we going to have in another generation or two? It's really kind of a scary thing to think about.
Jason, do you remember the name of the author that's associated with Downard? It's a weird name. I can never remember. And he did some writings on the outskirts of Downard. Do you know who I'm talking about?
No.
You don't remember? Anyhow, what I was about to say is get your hands on the books that James, or the writings that James Shelby Downard made possible, and Michael Hoffman, because they're going away. I got this book that looks like a cartoony paperback. It's got a cartoon version of James Shelby Downard's face on the front. It's maybe 100 pages, but when I first saw it, it was like $900 on Amazon. This is one of the ways they make it censored. At some point, it went down to, I remember 350, thinking this is way too much, but I got to grab it. This is why. When Michael Hoffman's no longer with us, when I'm no longer with us, will these writings even be possible to get your hands on if we end up dealing with the aristocracy trying to take control of everything longer than we should? So, I mean, it's a big deal. Get your hands on these books. And Jason, I know...
Are you referring to Adam Parfrey?
There it is. Adam Parfrey. I'll hazard the guess. Do you know what book I'm talking about?
That's how I looked it up. I thought that's what you're talking about, but I couldn't remember his name off the top of my head. So King Kill 33 was not a book unto itself. It was more of a treatment that was part of a book called Apocalypse Culture, which is a very famous counterculture anthology edited by Adam Parfrey and first published in 1987.
Can you do a quick lookup to see if it's even available on Amazon? And if it is, what the ridiculous price might be? I'm reasonably sure, and I don't have the best memory for things that I'm not hyper interested in. I know it was like $800 or $900, and I thought that's ridiculous. And then when it was $350, I knew it was ridiculous, but I also knew I had to have a copy and that it might not be possible.
It's so listed, but I don't see a price at all. Let me do a quick look through here. Oh, here we go. Paperback, 7 options from $23.93, and the Kindle version is $14.95. So yeah, it's still available.
Oh, wow. That's cheap, cheap, cheap. Get a hold of this. And what's going to happen when you go looking for the Shelby writings is it's this weird thing. I think you mentioned it to me, Jason. I noticed it. You get like versions of a thing you've already read with other parts that weren't there previous. And actually, Michael Hoffman sent me a box of writings. And actually, I'm not going to talk about that right now. I'm going to address that later. For some reason, I think maybe the effort to censor what Shelby had put out was so great that the way we got what he put down was through so few people that what was known got reiterated and what was also known just got added in or something like that. But for the sake of talking, Jason, I know this is a short hour one, but I don't want to talk just to fill an hour one. And I thought it was critically important to try to put a foundation down for people who aren't familiar with alchemical principle or spellcraft or geomancy or any of the things that James Shelby Downard put the key in the lock and opened the door for us to be able to comprehend.
Well, let's bring up this. The things that James Shelby Downard said, and then Michael Hoffman kept on going after Downard's passing. A lot of the other truthers or conspiracy folks who came afterwards kind of owed a lot of their eye-opening points of view to the work that these men had done, and Michael Hoffman still does to this day. And a lot of the things that go on today with conspiracy culture, I don't think they even realize how this came about. Once we didn't have people like Bill Cooper around anymore, it kind of changed. Post 9/11 is a very different truth culture, I guess you could call it, that would have existed back then.
Yeah, I think what you're pointing out is critical. It is foundational in the way Jason's pointing out. And just to be clear, a lot of Shelby's ire was pointed at the Masonic organizations. He points over, in everything I've read, he's pointing at just the most dirty, ludicrous, underhanded things that Masonic organizations at higher levels are involved in. And to put that firmly into context, Michael Hoffman, probably among the most censored people we know right now, for the simple truth that he's not going to mince words with how he feels about what's going on in the Middle East. And I think you all know what I'm pointing to. People yell at me all the time because I won't cover Israel or I won't cover this or that. Here's the problem. If Jason and I can't communicate, then there's zero value. So does it make sense for me to say things I know are going to get a reaction in a negative way? Or does it make sense for me to make known my feelings in a way that's not going to get the scope put directly between my eyes? Michael Hoffman doesn't pull any punches. He regularly talks about the horrific things that are going on in that part of the world. And I guarantee you that is why the censorship is aimed at him so heavily. And I don't know if you've noticed this, Jason, or not.
Well, yeah, of course. But one of the things we should definitely bring up about Michael Hoffman is the way he feels about the Catholic Church, because the way he views it versus the way a lot of other people view it, it's very different.
Yeah, that's a good point, too. Michael Hoffman loves the Catholic Church, just not the Catholic Church we have, because what he hates with a passion is what was done to the Catholic Church he loves. He wants to go back to the original ideas where usury was a mortal sin. He wrote a whole book on it to show that the reason we suffer with 33% APR and these ridiculous rates on our homes, because the Catholic Church. And before they did that, they were an organization that called usury a mortal sin. And so there's an older spiritual tradition that he sees real value. And as a matter of fact, I see the same value that he sees. And by the time, what do they call it, Vatican II comes along, they have just decimated in all the ways that matter the spiritual value of what once was. So here's a man writing books that are so critical of an organization that were once the possessors and curators of a faith that he finds valuable beyond expression.
And was Vatican II where they stopped doing full Latin masses and switched to English?
Oh, it's that and more. Vatican II is like everything that was against the rules yesterday is okay now. Just to put kind of a generalization that's not very specific. Almost everybody who takes issue with the Catholic Church will point at Vatican II. And it's an easy lookup. You can do it. Just watch the source if you look up Vatican II. You probably don't want to get the Vatican's point of view on Vatican II.
Well, yeah, I did just look it up. In fact, that is when the Latin Mass was replaced with modern local languages, wherever the thing was taking place in. So that's a big deal to some people. I actually know some folks locally who are really hardcore about, if it's not Latin Mass, you're not doing it right.
You know, it's funny, too, because of all the languages I wish that I could have a better handle on and that I've tried at times, there are two. One is Greek and one is Latin. And not for any cultural thing, although I am part Greek, so there is a cultural attachment there. And the myths, if I could read them in the original, I think I would get something more. But the Latin, it's a higher language to the point where there were even forms of Latin that even the general people who spoke it didn't speak the priestly version. And when you read what's encapsulated in that language and vocabulary, it's truly a higher form of communication. So much more dense, much more involved in communicating critical ideas.
It's also the language that a lot of the great thinkers from many, many years ago would have been communicating in. You think that's kind of important to understand?
Case in point, up until my parents' generation, you know, you were going to get similar references. What did Socrates and Plato and, you know, the great thinkers of this time or that time think? And in my parents' time, and it was coming to an end there, in certainly junior high school, they were taking English to Latin to Greek or some semblance of that so that they could not only read, but write in each and transpose to each. That was actually part of a relatively common curriculum to show kind of how far we've fallen.
Now, when I was in school, and this would have been the 80s, three languages were offered: Spanish, French, and Latin. Do you think that's still the case?
I didn't even have Latin. We had Spanish and French. And when I came for the little bit of school I did here, Portuguese was instead of Spanish.
German's the other one that I had heard was being offered at schools in my area.
Yeah, a lot of people didn't take Latin. There was only a handful of my fellow students who decided to go that route. I took Spanish just because I thought it was the most practical. But if I knew then what I know now, I would have taken Latin.
What I was told in a school curriculum, I don't believe, and I could be incorrect in my memory, I don't think I was ever offered the opportunity for Latin. I'm pretty sure about that. But what I was being told in school was that it was a dead language. But you see, that's false on the face of it, because there's never been a time when the scientific nomenclature being applied to everything we figure out in the world wasn't Latin-based. And the thing about that, that most people don't realize in the era where they name a new spider after David Bowie, is that the names they were giving them were information dense. They weren't just words that were randomly assigned. It's almost like the idea, not quite the idea, but almost like the idea that way back in ancient times, they're claiming the language, the word for table, actually resonated with the object it was describing, along with the polarity, gender, and other things that could be included in a single expression or word that described it. So what I was being told was a complete falsehood. Latin has never been a dead language.
I think calling it that is kind of preposterous. Well, first of all, it's used in Vatican City, so it's not exactly dead if it's being used in places such as an ATM machine in Vatican City. I call that quite alive and well, although on a small scale. But with Latin being used in so much stuff, especially scientific concepts, it's not exactly dead if it's being used on a daily basis all over the world.
Right. And when I look at things now, like I get these old Latin texts that can now be translated, the one good use I found for AI, if someone's willing to do it for me, because I've sworn not to use it, is that if I can take the root, the prefix, and the suffix of a Latin word out of the gate, I know they're information rich. I can know more about whatever's being described just by understanding what does that root mean? What does that prefix mean? And how do they relate? And I don't have that in English. The language I was brought up in is devoid of the most basic concepts like gender. In the language I was brought up with, we don't even, you know, there is no gender in our language per se.
Well, yeah, gendered language. There's one that's a firecracker going off today. And of course, it's just being perverted to be a distraction instead of what is actually important about it.
Well, we've been trained to think the exact opposite, because when you spoke in one of the Latin-based languages, part of the idea was culturally sound. Like, this was the provisioned area of the culture of women in this culture. This is the provisioned area for the culture of men. And that was attached in the language. Like, a table would be la mesa. And in that culture, the women were providing for the family the most often with the kitchen table, which is why it probably had the feminine connotation. What we've been taught in our era is that that's rude, that's taking assumptions, that's assigning things, when there was a time when that was just culture. And it was just culture because it functioned in a way that everyone appreciated. And we've broken away from that. In the world that I've come up in, the very thing that James Shelby Downard and Michael Hoffman are pointing at is the reason that I can say things scot-free for the most part, is that there really is no American culture. We like some movies, we watch some TV. If you want to call baseball, apple pie, and Chevrolet culture, that's a little bit different than the culture that used to exist, I would estimate.
I don't know if I would say America has no culture. I would say that we lost our culture. The old school Americana, like 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s, some of the 60s, we had something. We had an image on the world stage that was very, very respected. And that is the America. That is the place that people from other lesser countries, not to insult them, but places that just weren't as successful as the United States was at the time, that's what they wanted to come to. That's what they wanted a piece of. And understandably so. That was when the American dream actually was a reality for many, many people. It was a time when the dad could go to work, the mom could stay at home with the children. They could have a decent home. They could have a nice car. They could go on vacations. They could afford to go to restaurants because things balanced out better. And you didn't have to have a six-figure massive CEO salary just to be able to live a decent life. That has been taken away from us, especially by the 1970s. You absolutely saw a massive, massive decline in the capabilities of the average American.
And actually, that's a good point. I should be more specific when I say we have no culture. By the time I was old enough to know anything about culture, it was pretty much devoid. We were just doing what we saw in the movies or any other thing. But Jason's absolutely right. There was a freedom, even just the car portion of our culture. We made the best cars. And there was this idea that America was an open road. And we had the freedom to do it. And everyone lived it because guess what? You turned 15, you knew it was that year you were going to start learning to drive. And when I came up, that was the year you got handed your keys. And then by the time you were 16 and could drive without an adult, there was a literal, true sense of freedom. I remember it because I lived it. I had a car I could access. I had keys in my hand. Guess what? I'm going to work. I'm making money. And I can drive anywhere I want for the most part. And that is very different than the world we live in now. And that's just one sliver of what once was the Americana Jason's pointing at.
And this actually reminds me of a video I was watching last night on diner culture. There used to be diners all over this country. And the video I was watching was describing just how they were intentionally affordable for anyone. And it was describing like the top 20 sandwiches, the kinds of things that you would normally find and how they sprung up and also why they died out. And when did they start dying out? The 1970s again.
It's funny you should bring that up. We actually still have diners and they're in the old rail cars, some of them, but it is on its last legs now. I don't even know. Maybe COVID finished them off, but maybe 8-9 years ago, there were still a couple diners and they were still in the old rail car or had the building that looked like the rail car, which was typical of the diners in this area. And you could still get an affordable meal. And that too was a crucial part of working man culture in this part of the world anyhow.
It absolutely was. And I found out not too long ago, the one diner that was in the area where I'm originally from in Pennsylvania is closed. And when I heard that, I was like, well, that's like the passing of something that'll never be seen again. Because I used to go there all the time when I was younger. And it kind of upset me. I liked the food. It was very different from corporate restaurants. It was more of a homemade style, which was the whole point of the diner. It was kind of like grandma's making you food at home and you could find those all over the place on the road. And it was just a very major staple in Americana that, I mean, yes, there are still diners here and there, especially in Jersey. New Jersey actually still has quite a few diners, but that's one of the few places that they still exist.
You know, people talk about resets and to me, it's no mystery. Of the few events that were massive that went down in my life, like 9/11, we always refer to, I can give examples of how we once lived just being wiped off the table. With 9/11, the one that struck me the most was before 9/11, when you wanted a trip, a lot of people chose a travel agent. And there was this, I don't know how to describe it. It was pleasant, the whole thing. They helped you. They tailored it. Everything was provided. You just showed up and you did what was already prepared for you. When 9/11 happened, they went offline and they never came back. So travel agents after 9/11 gone.
That was a big deal in our culture because the big mall where I grew up, there was an actual, not a store, but like a location in the mall that was nothing but several travel agents. They had their desks and all the posters and pamphlets and all that, and that's what it was there for. So think about that. It could afford a space in a mall where normally you have all these other stores and things that they could afford that to offer their service and make money. And that's gone now.
They were in the know. They got the deals. The plane carriers were catering to them because they brought business. But where did they make fun of that? Do you remember? There's a travel agent in the Truman Show, isn't there? And from the poster on the wall to exactly how the travel agent acts, I think that's a direct poke in the eye to the openly known plan by those at the top that that would be a thing that went away, because that is in The Truman Show.
Well, The Truman Show is a 90s film. So the 90s, as we've discussed so many times, and in my very hard opinion, is the last of the original decades of Western culture. I think after that, things just crashed and burned, and intentionally, I'm sure. But yeah, The Truman Show came out, I forget what year, late 90s, second half of the 90s. And you can see, even the town that Truman is in, this make-believe town, it's way more like an older town, even from the 90s point of view. It was very much that white picket fence kind of, the white picket fence and all that kind of idea. It was, since it was supposed to be a controlled environment, it wasn't hard for them to make it look like a classic American town.
Right. And to include a travel agent in that film was before 9/11 had happened. And no one needs to be told that's listening to this now what happened in 2020. How many businesses went away? How many were broken beyond repair? How many things in general are no longer here because of that whole couple years that went down?
Well, another thing with travel agents were they're often, unlike today, where so many things are just corporate and franchises of corporations, they might have been an independent broker on their own doing what they do. That sort of thing is just diminishing year by year.
Yeah. Every time you see any kind of a merger, what you're looking at is the day, getting closer to the day when there's one corporation over everything. Although, you know, the argument gets made all the time how few actually controls. As a matter of fact, I think maybe it was 2 or 3 years ago, people were up in arms about BlackRock buying one single family homes. And I think they said, what are you upset about? It's 14% or something. I remember a mathematician saying 14%. I just did the math. And that means over this period of time, you'll own everything. Well, the truth came out last year. I think it was 44%. So everything is creeping in that one corporation kind of idea. And to me, this all fits hand in glove with what is being unmasked in the work of James Shelby Downard and by extension, Michael Hoffman. And actually, Michael Hoffman, the only living active example of what Shelby opened the door to.
Well, that's going more towards that whole concept that they're pushing on us with Ming the Merciless, Klaus Schwab, that you'll own nothing and you'll be happy. Yeah, if some big corporation owns all the single family homes, obviously you're not buying them because those not so desirable individuals, I won't use a naughtier word, have control over just about all of it. So yeah, you won't own your home. You'll rent it from them.
Everything by subscription, which is another way of saying you'll own nothing. There was something that was put before me a week ago. I don't know if it's true, but the claim was that someone had bought a new vehicle. I think it might've been a Bronco, and it was white, if I remember, which got me thinking about how valid it was. But the claim was they missed a payment, so the Bronco company shut his car down. The only problem is the claim is they shut it down while he was in the middle of an intersection. Now, we heard a similar thing, if I'm not mistaken, about a Tesla, Jason, a similar thing going on. Somehow a Tesla got shut off when it was in an unsafe place. And this really underscores, you know, it was not more than a decade ago where any activity like this actually happened in the real world. It would have been just viewed as unacceptable. And now we're looking at it. This is the norm. The cities are falling apart. People are moving out of LA quicker than you can shake a fist. It looks like some cities like LA, where billionaires' mansions are regularly being walked away from now, that the alchemical procedure has succeeded to a certain level.
Well, if you have a computer in your car, you just never know what could be going down. And I actually had this conversation with David Avocado Wolf on one of the times that he had visited us in our home. This is the reason he maintains, I forget what year, I think he said it was a 2000. It was a Jeep of some kind, one of the nicer, bigger ones. And he said, I will always maintain this vehicle because there's no massive computer controlling it. And I took that to heart. We have an older van that I keep around for that exact reason. One, it's good for emergencies because it's high off the ground, but it's one of those old school vans, the kind my dad used to drive when I was a kid in the 80s. That's what he drove. So I nicknamed it after him, Big John. And there are no massive computers in it. I'm sure it's got a little one, but it's a 1999. And that vehicle is, for the most part, pretty much an analog machine.
I heard rumor that they're starting to try to get legislation moving that outlaws older vehicles that they can't put kill switches in. But when David Avocado Wolf showed up here years ago, he was driving that vehicle. What I witnessed here was I had a 2014 that was, for the most part, I mean, it had just the very bare minimum of what you might consider computerized, but not to the degree that it was kill switch and all that. The 2016 had started to change. By the time 2020 got here, all bets were off. And what I learned was after 2016 is the real acceleration towards just total control, to the point where we're now hearing about farmers who are trying to sue companies because they're not allowed to fix their vehicles. And they're saying, wait a minute, we bought this, don't we own it? Now they're trying to act like they're going to go to a subscription for the key. I mean, it's getting nutty out there.
Oh, that's absolutely to the point of ridiculousness. A subscription for a service that's already built into your vehicle, but you can't have it unless you pay the monthly fee. You know what? Screw that. Absolutely not. That concept has got to be buried. As a matter of fact, BMW tried that crap. I think it was with heated seats, and people freaked out about it when they found out, and they had to walk that back, as I understand.
Yeah, the problem is they just keep coming at it from different angles.
They'll just come up with something else. That's what they always do.
Yeah.
Okay, well, that one didn't work. Well, we'll figure out another one. We're going to get you because we can.
Till the end of time, they keep coming and keep coming till it weasels through. But I feel like we've laid down a foundation that makes the point that all this stuff we are seeing is really what's being decoded. And what's being decoded in Shelby's work and Hoffman's work is how it was implemented, the kind of occult dark methods that were used. And in the case of Shelby, the organizations directly fingered that were doing it. And I think a lot of people that read King Kill have their eyes open and they're astonished, but they may not be drawing the line to the degree of malfeasance that we've tried to illustrate here.
Well, to finish up, you had shown me this little paragraph that Michael Hoffman includes in his newsletter. Shall I read that now?
It's the best description in a paragraph that I have ever read that tries to outline what you and I just tried to outline.
Why are Americans inert? Indeed, almost paralyzed in the midst of so many dramatic revelations lately concerning the perfidious iniquity of our rulers. Centuries ago, it was deduced that in this time and place, after enough immersion in the alchemical crucible, the people would be in a psychological decay state where we are exhausted by the truth. In past generations, revelations of high crimes would have been revitalizing incentives to concerted action in bringing perpetrators to justice. In the West, in century 21's society of the spectacle, they are mostly grist for the thrill of the week on the part of a mass of degenerate voyeurs spectating at their own demise, at which they aspire to obtain a front row seat. Well done, Michael Hoffman.
I mean, words don't express any better than what, I mean, that last line kills me every time. In the West, in century 21 society of the spectacle, they are mostly grist for the mill of the week on the part of the mass of degenerate voyeurs spectating at their own demise, at which they aspire to obtain a front row seat. And if that isn't the cap on the bottle, I don't know what is. I think we've gone as far as we can go. Michael Hoffman's next, and I urge, don't miss Michael Hoffman. He is a critical source while we have him.
Yeah, that was definitely a great little hour we had with him. And by the way, for anyone who is thinking about tuning in for hour two, which you should, at the very end, I asked him what was the craziest thing that James Shelby Downard believed in that turned out to be true. And for once, I actually heard Michael Hoffman have a good laugh, as did you.
That's a good point. That is the first time I've heard him laugh at it. What did he believe that turned out to be true? I'd say the majority of what I've read from him. The problem is it's like a magical spell. You can't kind of put a thumbtack in it to prove it. But deductive reasoning and simple observation should tell you that what they're defining happened and the outcome is in front of our eyes. And it is up to us to recognize it and quit participating in this, what do you say, the spectacle of the week, quit looking for the front row seat. Stop accepting what is unacceptable. With that, I'm going to bring hour one to a close of episode 695, and I'd like to wish you all a happy, healthy, and higher-minded new era. Don't miss hour two with Michael Hoffman. There it is, man. Cheers.
Belief is the enemy of knowing.